This is Issues and Ideas. I'm this week's host, Larry Rutter. Today we're going to court.
I'm a very strong believer that we have the best judicial system in the world. I've traveled to other countries as part of judicial delegations, and I feel so lucky that we do have a right to a jury trial, where in many countries there are no jury trials. Judges make decisions based on police reports, no live witnesses, and I think we have a fair system for everyone.
We're going to learn about some theater.
And of course, sword fighting for the stage is a little different than other forms of sword fighting, like fencing, where the intention is to disguise what you're doing and actually hit your opponent. We kind of do exactly the opposite.
And we're going to savor some farm fresh food and vineyard fresh drink.
And they have a huge variety of Asian specialty vegetables. These are not available at most farmers markets, but we are able to offer them at our farmers market, and they're quite unique.
All this on Issues and Ideas on KCBX. It's hard to believe today. It's hard to believe that some of the changes that have taken place in our judicial system over the years. Once only men could sit on juries, there was a time in my lifetime when the only women in an official capacity in a courtroom was the stenographer. And there were virtually no female judges, no Hispanic judges, and certainly no female prosecutors or criminal defense attorneys. How times have changed. But some people had to lead the way, and my guest today has done just that, not only as a woman, she's led the way in many areas. She was the first Latina deputy DA in Orange County, the first woman deputy DA in San Luis Obispo County, the first woman to be appointed to the municipal court in the county, the first woman to prosecute a murder case in San Luis Obispo County, the first to use DNA evidence in a trial in SLO County, and the first Hispanic in over 100 years to serve as a superior court judge in the county. But she retired a year or so ago, and just last Friday, in a very special ceremony, she was awarded the Joan Dempsey Klein Distinguished Juris Award for 2013 by California Women Lawyers. The Honorable Teresa Estrada Mullaney, I can't tell you how honored we are to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate being on your show.
One of the things that people wanted me to ask you right away was, in that murder case you tried with DNA evidence, did you win?
It wasn't a murder case. It was a sexual assault case. Oh. And yes, there was a conviction of the defendant. The case was People versus Garcia. I handled the case from 1989 through 1991. It was a two-year process. There were eight victims of sexual assault, and his sentence was 76 years to life. Of course, back then, sentences were shorter for sexual assault cases. Under today's sentencing laws, it would have probably been many more years.
But you said it's 76 years to life?
76 to life. And I did the math back then, and he will be 80 years old when he's eligible for parole.
Being the first at anything can sometimes be a bit uncomfortable. But you seem to thrive on this. There had to be moments of some considerable discomfort along the way, being the first Hispanic or the first woman in it. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Give me some examples.
Well, My first day on the job in Orange County as a deputy DA, there were six new lawyers arriving for the first day on the job. Four men and two women. Five of the new lawyers were escorted into a special waiting area, and I was told to wait in the lobby. When I asked why, the receptionist said to me, "Well, those are our new attorneys, and all of the new secretaries have to wait here in the lobby. Your supervisor will be out to get you very soon." That's just one example.
Give me another one.
Going into my first judges meeting in San Luis Obispo as the only woman made me feel that I was entering into a network of the old boys club. I very much felt that. Mm-hmm. And a couple of times it was obvious to me that they had to try to tone down their language because now there was a woman present in the meeting.
I suppose things have changed over the years. Even up until your retirement, any scant evidence of still some trouble being a woman in the judicial system?
I don't know if I would call it trouble. I think some members of the public are still not used to seeing women as judges. But definitely that has changed since 1992 when I was first appointed to the bench.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes you think when you first walk in the room that there's some little, holy Toledo, that is a woman instead of a man?
Oh, not much anymore. Uh-huh. But certainly in those first years, I have lots of woman judge stories, litigants mm-hmm. expecting to see a man and being disappointed to see a woman. One of my favorite stories is a small claims plaintiff, cabinet maker, who was suing for non-payment of a special order set of kitchen cabinets. It was obvious to me by his body language, his look of frustration, that he really didn't think I was understanding his case. So he said to me, "Judge, let me put it in terms that you might understand. Maybe you could think of it as a situation where you made a special order cake and the customer refused to pay for it."
Did he win his case?
I don't remember.
Darn. On a more serious note, your parents were immigrants. I understand
yes.
Your first language was Spanish?
That's correct. I didn't speak English until I started the first grade.
And then, bingo, you graduated from UCLA Law. How'd you do it?
My parents very much wanted more for their children. That was part of the reason they came to the United States. My dad earned his citizenship by his service in the United States Army during World War II. Oh. And after the war, they moved to California. My brother and I were both born in Los Angeles, and my dad would be gone from home for weeks at a time working. My mother would get up before dawn to fix us a hot breakfast, pack our lunches, and then she'd be off to work as a seamstress in the garment district in Los Angeles. And I like to say that my brother and I were the best cared for latchkey kids in the neighborhood. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship, a partial scholarship, to Mount St. Mary's College in Los Angeles. And then after my marriage to my wonderful husband, John, in 1966, I completed my bachelor's degree at Loyola Marymount. Mm-hmm. When I graduated in 1970, I had actually wanted to be a teacher. My husband was teaching for the LA Unified District, but then there was a teacher strike followed by a hiring freeze, so I decided not to seek my credential. Sibling rivalry was the reason that I chose law as a career path. I decided that if my brother could do it, so could I. But we knew that we couldn't afford for me to go to law school right away. So I worked for 4 years. And then I was lucky enough to be accepted into one of the best law schools in the nation, UCLA. And that's how all of that happened. I worked primarily as a waitress during those 4 years because I decided that I could make more money doing that with my bachelor's degree than looking for another position. And I really feel that my waitress experience was one of the best jobs I could have had to train me to be a trial attorney.
Tell me more.
That's because in that job, I learned to deal with people from all walks of life. I learned quite a bit about time management, how to be efficient, waiting on five or six tables at one time, the whole attitude, if whenever possible, the customer is always right. Serve them with a smile on your face, even though they might have made a mistake about the order and they're blaming you. And one of the things that I noticed when I was an attorney, and again after I became a judge, was that some attorneys who've never had real-world experience before they go into a courtroom aren't really masters of dealing with people from different areas of our society. So, for example, a witness on the stand, they're asking a question, and they're using vocabulary that the witness doesn't understand, and the witness would have to say things like, "I'm sorry, I don't know what that word means," or "I don't understand your question."
Or sometimes they don't want to admit they don't understand what you're saying and answer the wrong question.
Yes. So I think that my job as a waitress really prepared me for being out in the world and dealing with people from everywhere.
We're talking with the Honorable Teresa Estrada Mullaney. She is retired about 18 months ago as a Superior Court judge in San Luis Obispo County and an award winner of the Joan Dempsey Klein Distinguished Jurist Award. And we wanted to know more about her, and we've invited her to our studios. In the law, who are your heroes?
My role model and inspiration to become a judge was the Honorable Francis Munoz, retired judge of the Orange County Superior Court. I met her when I did an internship during law school at the Orange County Public Defender's Office. She was an attorney. I worked with her during that internship. And in 1978, Governor Jerry Brown, in his first time around as governor, appointed her as the first Latina judge in the history of California. And that's what inspired me that someday I would like to apply for a judgeship. Once I became an attorney and moved to this county, my role model and hero for a judge was the Honorable William Fredman, who presided over many of the criminal trials that I handled when I was a prosecutor. And unfortunately, he died just 1 week before my appointment to the bench. Huh. I had asked him to swear me in as a judge if I would ever be able to become one.
Mm-hmm. I expected you to mention this Sandra Day O'Connor or some of the women on some of the higher courts. Any of those, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, et cetera, I suppose they all are excellent role models. But I just wondered if there's anybody on the national scene that particularly inspired you.
No, it was people that I worked with. Those two people inspired me the most for my eventual position as a judge. Especially Judge Fredman, because I was before him so many times on many different cases.
Do you think being Hispanic gives you some insight into people who come into your court who are Hispanic that others might not understand? I mean, I'm not talking about just language, but culture.
Well, in the area of language, I have benefited from knowing Spanish and having Spanish be my first language. And that is because the state budget does not allow to have interpreters in all courtrooms at all times. And so sometimes I would be required to ask people, please have a seat. We're waiting for the interpreter. It won't be long for your case. And that made me feel that at least I could be helpful to them. And one thing that I've heard over the years from people, litigants, observers in court, is that people appreciate someone who looks like them in court. And perhaps that has made a difference to some people. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of just the I was thinking of cultural norms, not necessarily language or even looking. But I wonder if there's some cultural differences that maybe the California courts generally aren't yet sensitive enough to.
Well, I had one case where a defense attorney was telling me that the client's behavior was not criminal in Mexico, and that I should be aware of that and sympathetic to the fact that it was a crime here but not in Mexico. And I knew from my own background that that was not true. So that's the first example that I think of.
Generally speaking, do you think the legal system in California gives a fair break to Hispanics? Or does it depend on the jurisdiction and the court and things like that?
I'm a very strong believer that we have the best judicial system in the world. I've traveled to other countries as part of judicial delegations, and I feel so lucky that we do have a right to a jury trial, where in many countries there are no jury trials. Judges make decisions based on police reports, no live witnesses, and I think we have a fair system for everyone.
You've been a visiting judge since you retired, so, and you've, I imagine, been all over the state?
Yes. I'm very happy that, unlike other professions, judges can continue a career even after an official retirement. In California, we have a program called the Assigned Judges Program, where you turn in your application indicating what areas of law you would like to specialize in. And I work around the state. So far this year, I've worked 48 days, and I have commitments to work about another 35 more through the rest of the year. I'm enjoying it very much. My husband is able to travel with me for most of those trips, and we take care of my 92-year-old mother for part of the year, and she has gone on some of those trips with us.
Really? Like where? Where have you been a judge?
I've been to Placer County, the county seat of Roseville, Porterville in Tulare County, Lamont in Kern County, Santa Maria, Santa Barbara, to name a few.
I, at one time in my life, spent a lot of time up in the foothills in Amador County and was actually quite familiar with the judicial system up there. It seems to me kind of a unique system up there. And I imagine that in some of the, like Placer County and whatnot, they do things a little differently.
Yes, and that's one of the pleasures of serving in this program, is that you learn new techniques for doing calendars. In different courts, they might call a procedure by a different name that I have than I have been used to over the years. So I love meeting new people, and my career is wonderful. I enjoy being able to continue doing the work that I did here for 20 years and now in different places all around the state.
I guess, have you found anything that's sort of surprised you when you've gone to some of the other courts? Attitudes here are different, juries are different, the jury selection process, the expectations for the courts?
Oh, there are lots of little things that I've noticed that there are differences. For example, some courts don't have the security that other courts do, and that has to do with our state budget. Some courts' sentencing policies are different from what I've been used to. So, for example, in driving under the influence cases, I've noticed that some counties are not as strict as I have been used to in San Luis Obispo, and quite frankly, I've been a little disappointed about that.
Really?
Yes.
Huh. And there is enough county-by-county discretion on that? I thought sort of state law prevailed in a lot of ways.
Oh, there are some mandatory sentences, including fines, but when it comes to jail time, there is some discretion in many areas of lower-level criminal offenses.
And drunk driving is one of those.
Yes.
Well, I can understand that. There are cultural differences in the state and attitudes toward that.
That's right. Unless someone is injured in a driving under the influence case, there can be quite a bit of discretion when it comes to the jail part of the sentence.
We're talking with the Honorable Teresa Estrada Mullaney. She retired about 18 months ago as a Superior Court judge in San Luis Obispo County, and just a few days ago received the Joan Dempsey Klein Distinguished Jurist Award from the California Women Lawyers. Absolutely a highly distinctive award and a highly distinctive career, and we're finding out more about her. A lot of people in California sort of wring their hands and think that there are some fundamental flaws in our judicial system, and yet you seem to be a pretty big fan of, for instance, mandatory sentencing laws, for instance. A lot of people and a lot of judges seem to object to that. Are there any other aspects of the system generally, especially as you've traveled around and seen how it's applied, that you would make changes about?
I think that there are some cases that perhaps a six-person jury would be much more efficient for the court system. But that has been suggested many times, and so far it hasn't happened yet. But some states do have that.
Florida, the Trayvon Martin
jury
was six people.
I see no problem with six-person juries, in misdemeanors at least.
Yeah. Let me ask you, in your career, what case or cases stand out as the most difficult for you as a judge?
As a judge, probably the most difficult, I can think of two, were the civil case, commonly known as the Paso earthquake case, that I tried here in San Luis Obispo in 2007 and 2008. That was when the earthquake caused the collapse of the Acorn building in Paso and two women died. Mm-hmm. It was an unlawful death jury trial. There were experts from all over the United States as well as attorneys from several cities. And then there was also the juvenile murder case that I tried where a teenager who wasn't yet 14 years old bludgeoned an 87-year-old man to death here in the city of San Luis Obispo. And I would say that was very difficult because not just listening to the evidence, but deciding what was the appropriate consequence for this teenager.
There's a lot, if you look in the internet about that particular case, 14-year-old boy, that was not a jury trial. Is that correct?
Juveniles are not entitled to jury trials in California.
So you basically were judge and jury in that particular. And what did you decide?
I decided to send him to the maximum sentence available at the California Youth Authority, where he could be held until the age of 25.
Mm-hmm. And what made that so difficult?
I don't want to go into the details of some of the evidence that was presented, but his defense attorneys were taking the position that since he had not been into the system at all previously, that sending him to such a place would ultimately be detrimental to him as an adult.
Mm-hmm. And yet you did sentence him to the maximum.
I did, because I felt that that was the appropriate consequence for what he did.
Mm-hmm. The opportunity presents itself, I imagine, frequently of young people who approach you about the legal profession as a career. Do you recommend it? And what do you tell people about how they should view the legal profession as a potential career today?
Just a few days ago, I was discussing the state of law as a career in California with one of the deans at UCLA School of Law. And she told me that enrollment has been down in the last couple of years, and she believes it's as a result of our state's economy. But I'm always telling young people to follow their dreams. And even if a dream that you might have at the age of 18 doesn't work out, start a new dream. I don't want anyone to feel that because there might not be a choice position waiting for them when they graduate from law school and pass the state bar examination, that they should just give up on something that is their love and their passion. So I encourage people to follow their dreams, whatever they might be.
In California, judges, Superior Court judges are elected, and sometimes in contested elections, sometimes uncontested elections. You feel comfortable with having, I know you've been in at least one contested election. Do you feel comfortable as a jurist who wants to be entirely independent and dispassionate about the cases before them, about what you have to do to get elected in a popularity contest for judge?
That's an excellent question. My election to the Superior Court was in 1996. The Honorable Harry Wolpert had retired, and back then there were both municipal and superior courts. And then a few years after that, the municipal court was abolished, so now there are only superior courts in California. That experience included some highlights and lowlights. The best part of that campaign for me was precinct walking. I very much enjoyed knocking on doors, introducing myself, and asking people to vote for me. One of the most difficult aspects of a contested judicial election is fundraising, because you can't make promises to the voters the way people running for Congress or the Assembly might. So that was a negative. But I really appreciate the fact that I am friends with my opponent in the general election. There was a runoff in November of 1996 between me and the Honorable Barry LaBarbera, who was district attorney of the county at the time, and he was one of the speakers at my award ceremony on Friday night. And you can't do better than that, than making a friend of an opponent in an election campaign.
And it did it any way, having to run for an election, did it in any way sort of change your view about the job of being a judge? Because you had to be a politician and then be a judge.
It actually changed my view in a positive way, because many people don't realize that you can be in election to be a judge. Most judges are appointed and never have to run for election. In California, we have 6-year terms, and after your appointment, yes, you are up for election, but if no one runs against you, then you file your papers and your name isn't even on the ballot. But if a seat opens up, maybe there is a retirement and you're running for a position, it makes the whole process so different. And ultimately, now, all of these years afterwards, I think of it as one of the most positive experiences of my career.
This has been a very interesting conversation. I really enjoyed the chance to visit with you today and to get a little insight into it. You are a truly remarkable woman, and we are just honored that you could be with us today. The Honorable Judge Teresa Estrada Mullaney, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me on your show.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter. Coming up, we're going to market.
We also have California Bee Company Honey. He is a local beekeeper here in the area, and he offers it's absolutely the most delicious honey I've ever tasted.
And learn about sword fighting and great theater. Support for KCBX is provided by the Basin Street Regulars, the Central Coast Hot Jazz Society, presenting America's music at the Vets Hall in Pismo Beach. Complete information on the Basin Street Regulars is available at pismojazz.com. The PCPA Theater Fest is widely recognized as one of the crown jewels of the Central Coast arts and entertainment scene. Their offerings are almost uniformly theatrically dazzling. Seldom a disappointment. That's true whether they're performing in Santa Maria or, as they are now this summer, at the Solvang Festival Theater. After being away for a while, I was just this week given a peek at what they're offering this summer and thought, wow, this is something I should have known about, and I want our audience to be fully aware of it. So we called up, and we're talking with the Artistic Director and Associate Dean, Mark Boer, and we're going to find out from Mark what's going on this summer. Good afternoon, Mark.
It's nice to be with you.
You told me that you just came out from a fight rehearsal for one of the offerings?
That's right. Well, we've got Spamalot on stage right now down in the Solvang Festival Theater. We're in rehearsals right now for Cyrano de Bergerac, and among the things that I'm doing this summer is doing the fight direction for that show. It's being directed by Roger Delaurier, but I get to work on the wonderful sword fighting part of that piece.
What sort of preparation do you need to do to be a fight director?
Well, for me, it started out when I was an actor training and as you know, being an actor combatant and learning basic sword fighting technique. And, of course, sword fighting for the stage is a little different than other forms of sword fighting like fencing, where the intention is to disguise what you're doing and actually hit your opponent. We kind of do exactly the opposite. We try and show what we're doing and not hit our opponent, who's also our partner in the storytelling. And so, you know, there's a good deal of technical training that people go through. There's actually a society called the American Society of Fight Directors that creates standards for training. And I received my training both in undergraduate and graduate school under a wonderful fight director named Chris Bia. But basically, you learn it by doing it. And so now I think that Cyrano de Bergerac is probably about the 50th or so production that I've done the fight direction for.
And I suppose that it's important from two reasons. One, to be realistic, but also so people don't get hurt.
Absolutely. Yeah. Those two things, you're absolutely right. Safety and repeatability. And really, my two jobs as fight director are having a fight that is safe and effective on that front, but also that clearly tells the story. And because you can have, you know, some wonderfully dazzling moves, but if it doesn't actually, you know, advance the narrative and express something about the people who are doing the fighting, you know, then it's just kind of calisthenic. And so, you know, hopefully it captures those two things. It's something that's safe and repeatable for the actors that they can do 6 or 8 times a week, but also something that is thrilling and helps advance the story.
And doesn't it have to be believable as well? I mean, don't you want the audience to think, my gosh, these men are going to kill each other?
Yeah, hopefully there's something, you know, it's realistic enough that it has a, I think all of us when we go to the theater know that we're entering, you know, what we hope will be a plausible fiction. And we know that we're not actually seeing somebody impaled with a sword. I don't think that that's something that any of us would actually want to watch, is to see someone get stabbed. You know, so I think that there's a certain level of that often talked about willing suspension of disbelief where the audience agrees as part of the team that, yeah, we're going to make believe that this is a real sword fight. But we want to help them as much as we can by having something that's, you know, that looks realistic enough to evoke their imagination. And of course, you know, my hope is that we're going to accomplish that with Cyrano. I have to say, so far in rehearsal, I'm pretty excited about how that's going to work.
Well, we don't want to give the impression that it's the only thing you're doing this summer, because you
that's
have
right.
three, I think, outstanding selections. Three of them, different in every way from each other, Stellar Theater. Tell us about them in order. Let's start out with...
Well, we actually have, you know, so what's on... In fact, in total, we'll do 5 plays this summer. We've already opened and closed one of them, which was a remount of our wonderful production of Fiddler on the Roof. That's now had its run down in the Solvang Festival Theater and has closed. But right now on stage in Solvang is Spamalot, which is the musical that's lovingly ripped off from the Monty Python movie, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So it's a... And this is, you know, one of these great fresh offerings. It's right off of Broadway and its national tour. And this is an original PCPA production. But it just has all this sort of great, zany lampoon that all of us Monty Python fans have come to love and is a wonderful piece of musical comedy. We're following that up with next up is Cyrano de Bergerac, I think one of the greatest verse plays ever written. It's just a recipe for... heroic passion and poetry, and you know, Cyrano is sort of that great Renaissance man, poet and warrior and lover, and so it's certainly one of the greatest love stories of all time. And then a story that our audiences have loved and that we're bringing back to the stage is Always Patsy Cline, which is this great jukebox musical, you know, sort of one of the ones that set the standard for that genre, and Kitty Bailey, one of our resident actors, is coming back to reprise the role of Patsy Cline that she did probably about 15 years ago. And I think there are 28 Patsy Cline songs in this show, so it's going to be fantastic. That actually starts out in Santa Maria in the Severson Theater, our small space, and then we'll move down to the Solvang Festival Theater. And then the last up is a show that only plays in Santa Maria, the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award winning Clybourne Park by Bruce Norris. And so that will close out our season. And it's a fantastic, very thought-provoking and sort of gut-churning look at race and real estate. And the interesting thing is it's very funny and very thought-provoking at the same time, and I think that's probably the reason it won both the Pulitzer and Tony Awards. So it's a great play. I'm really excited to bring it to our audiences, and we, in fact, got the rights while it was still running on Broadway and just prior to its winning the Tony Award, so we are feeling really excited to bring it here to the Central Coast.
Wow. Mark Boer is who we're talking to. He's the artistic director, among other things, at PCPA Theater Fest, and we're just enthralled by the offerings this summer and wanted to find out a little bit more about them and make sure you in our audience had a chance to know what they are doing. I see where... Eric Stein is in Spamalot. I wondered what Eric was doing these days. I know he performs in almost every one of your productions, it seems
He's going to have quite a run. Of course, you know, our audience has really enjoyed Eric's work as Tevye. And what was great is I think our audiences have come to know what an amazing comedian Eric is. And he's really, you know, he regularly makes my side ache because he's so funny. But it was really wonderful to get to see him do a role like Tevye, which not only, you know, is there a sense of humor to it, but I think the pathos of that part and, you know, the father who is losing not only his daughters, but, you know, the traditions of his community and the great change that was going on in his world. And I think all of us, you know, relate to that, is how we deal with loving and losing. And I thought Eric's performance, that was so moving. But then to have him follow that up in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where he's playing Lancelot, but also really silly parts like the leader of the knights who say knee and Tim the Enchanter, and you know, to go into that wonderful, ludicrous world again. And then he's right now in rehearsals to play Ragueneau in Cyrano de Bergerac. And it's one of the things that I think makes PCPA unique as a company is the resident artists here, not just the actors, but the designers and the directors, you know, really have to approach a variety of genre and artistic pieces and give an equal commitment to all of them. So it's wonderful, I think, for our audiences to be able to track Eric Stein or Michael Jenkinson or Kitty Bailey through a summer season.
Is it hard? I was thinking about Spamalot. Did you guys have to struggle to get the rights for something like that?
We have the acquiring the rights. That's a great question. Acquiring the rights isn't always easy, and so to bring the freshest material here to the Central Coast, plays like Spamalot and Clybourne Park, and the show that we'll kick off our 50th anniversary season, the great musical Mary Poppins, landing the rights to do those shows is sort of a challenge, and but it's part of our commitment to not only, you know, bring the great classics of the stage to our audiences and keep that in our shared cultural literacy, but also to, you know, bring shows that you'd otherwise have to go to Chicago or New York or Los Angeles to see right here to the Central Coast. But that's the fun part of my job, is trying to acquire the rights to these plays, because they're pretty hot properties, as it were. But I want our audiences to be able to stay home and see them here in Solvang or Santa Maria.
And there's a bit of gamesmanship involved in that, too, isn't there? And also there's a bit of a gamble sometimes. You think you have it, and then you don't have it.
Yeah, there's a little bit about that. On occasion, we'll acquire the rights for something, and then something will change on the national scene or that could affect that. Usually, you know, once we've announced the season, we've got things locked down in such a way that that we're able to follow through with that offering. But when you're trying to bring new material to the stage, it can be a little bit tricky at times.
If you do something like Patsy Cline, which is, that'll be your, I guess, your third offering this summer, you have to have your star, really, before you could decide that that's what you're going to do.
Yeah, there are some of those shows. If you're going to do a production like Always Patsy Cline, or, you know, say, for example, our upcoming production of Hamlet, or if you're going to do Cyrano de Bergerac, you kind of want to have that title character, the actor who's going to play that role, in mind. It's not something where you would necessarily pick a play and, you know, and then go looking for that title role. You know, having said that, though, I think that does happen on occasion, because any of those three pieces that I mentioned, I think, would be plays that we would put in our season just based on the quality of the material itself, not because it's a star vehicle for, you know, for a particular actor, although it certainly, I think, on the backside ends up being that. But, you know, we first want to pick plays that we have a core conviction that they're just great and need to be seen. I think then what immediately follows, if you're thinking about Always Patsy Cline, is, well, who does Patsy? And in the case of a show like this that has a history with the company and Kitty Bailey, who's still in the company, of course, as soon as we started considering Patsy Cline, Kitty was the first person I talked to.
Yes, absolutely. And we're talking with Mark Boer, the artistic director of PCPA. The Severson Theater is still under construction, or will that be ready for the fall?
Actually, the Severson Theater, which is the smaller of our two spaces, has been in ongoing operation and remains open. So we produced a production of The Tempest in there this last spring, and Always Patsy Cline and Clybourne Park will play in the Severson Theater. The theater you're thinking of is the Marion Theater, named after Marion Hancock on the Allen Hancock College campus. It has been in a renovation project since January of this last year, and that project is nearing completion now. We're probably 5 or 6 weeks away, so toward the end of August, we're going to be moving back into the Marion Theater, so I'm very happy to say that PCPA will be producing again in the Marion Theater in Santa Maria for the 50th anniversary season. So we'll reopen that space with a gala opening performance of Mary Poppins on November 9th. And so, of course, it'll take a... When you move out of a four-story theater, it takes a little time to move back in. All of the equipment, all of the storage, all of the infrastructure will have to move back in after the renovation project is done. But that'll get started in late August, early September, and we'll be up and running to open Mary Poppins.
Never a dull moment in the theater.
Yeah, it's very exciting, and I'm so proud and so respect the work of the company, who's not only producing a five-show summer season, but is in the midst of, you know, these major facility transitions, and they continue to do really exemplary artistic work while keeping it all happening behind the scenes.
You're absolutely right, and we're very proud of it. If people want to know more, why don't we deal with the nuts and bolts of that, Mark? How they can find out more about how they can get tickets and all that kind of stuff?
Well, the great thing is they can find out the entire performance schedule by going to our website, which is pcpa.org. On the World Wide Web. So, and that's, you can not only find out what the performance schedule is, you can buy tickets live online, and so pick your date and buy your tickets, and you'll be ready to go to the theater. And of course, if they want to talk to a person, which we always want to be there as well, the box office number is 922-8313.
And that, I presume, that phone number is also on your website as well.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, Mark Boer, Artistic Director of PCPA, I really enjoyed talking with you. If I had the time, we would talk for hours. You have to get back to your fight. And we have to go on. But I want to thank you very much. And as they say in your business, break a leg.
Thanks so much, Larry. We hope to see you at the theater.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Larry Rutter. Farmers markets are becoming more and more an important feature of our lives. New ones seem to pop up with some regularity. Well, starting late last month, a new one popped up in a place you might not have expected it. It's at the Town Center Mall in Santa Maria. And we have the manager of the farmers market on the line. She's Christy Lashever. Good afternoon, Christy.
Good afternoon, Larry. Thank you for having me.
We're going to find out some of the details of the farmers market, but let me ask you a few sort of basic questions about the market. Is there anything special about what you offer that sort of distinguishes you from other northern Santa Barbara County markets?
Well, we do have a wonderful variety of fruit and fresh produce. We have an organic beef vendor. He brings beef, free-range chicken. He's in the process of raising turkeys for the market, and these are all organic meats. Not every market has that. We have G Brothers Kettle Corn, which is always fun. We have Euphoria roses. And they're quite beautiful and very inexpensive. These are the same roses that you can get through the florist at a much reduced rate because they're direct from the grower. And we're just trying to offer a lot of fresh, interesting options for people.
I gather that it took you some time to get this all organized. What does it take to establish a farmer's market?
Well, these days it's a much more complicated process than it has been in years past. There's a very complicated permitting process with many cities and counties, and particularly in North Santa Barbara County, we had to apply for and receive permits not only from the health department, but from the planning department. And at one point, we have the Chamber of Commerce and the Downtown Merchants Associations on board. At this point in time, it's primarily a town center mall event. It is, however, a 501c3 that's been established in its as its own entity. And so you have to establish a 501c3. You have to get certification from the State of California Agriculture Department. It's very involved, time-consuming, and it can be very expensive.
And how do you go about getting vendors for something like this? Do you go out to the local farms, or do you go to other farmers markets?
Well, one of the folks that was most responsible for that was Varden Nonella, and Varden and his family own Best Apple Company. They're a small family farm in Nipomo, and he does many farmers markets throughout San Luis County and even all the way down to Ventura, and this is how they earn their living. So he's well connected with many of the vendors, and he was able to encourage and procure most of the vendors for us. Without him, we would not have been able to bring the market to Santa Maria.
Now, has he established or have you established any sort of criteria about what can be offered, what can't be offered, pricing? I'm just sort of blue skying here, but
Yes. As far as the pricing goes, these vendors do many different farmers markets and events, and they know what the market rate is for their product. That's their responsibility. As far as vendors coming into the market, and we are still accepting vendors into the market. However, at this point, we have certain criteria that they need to meet. They have to be either a certified food producer through the State of California Ag Department, or they have to have a cottage permit, which allows them to make different things in the home and bring them to the market. And then also we have folks that go through the health department for their permits and don't go through the state ag department. And those would be folks like G Brothers Kettle Corn, Best Apple Company, and the Central City Candy Company, which is here in the mall. And those folks go through the health department and receive their permits.
Do you think there's anything unique about your farmers market that others aren't offering that you're particularly proud of?
Well, we do have a produce vendor from over in Fresno. They come all the way over here from Fresno on Saturday morning, and they have a huge variety of Asian specialty vegetables. These are not available at most farmers markets, but we are able to offer them at our farmers market, and they're quite unique. We also have California Bee Company Honey. He is a local beekeeper here in the area, and he offers it's absolutely the most delicious honey I've ever tasted, And you don't always get that at a lot of farmers markets, but we have it at ours.
We don't know much about you, Christy Lashever, who is the manager of the market. What is your background? Are you a farmer by background?
No, I'm not a farmer, but I have been a vendor for a number of years at a variety of farmers markets. I also put on special events occasionally through other nonprofits or businesses here in the area, and I had started working on this about 4 years ago, and we were not able to bring it to being, and so I was talking to some of the folks over at the Santa Maria Chamber of Commerce, and they had mentioned speaking with Amber Leese, who's the manager at Town Center Mall, and so Amber and I got together, and after a few conversations, we decided that we could do this and bring it to the public, and that it was going to be a really beneficial thing because it is the only Saturday farmers market between downtown Santa Barbara and Arroyo Grande. And it's the only farmers market to open in the Santa Maria Valley in over 20 years.
My God.
So, and it serves the working people, because generally speaking, in this area, most homes are two-income households, and those folks are unable to get to the weekday farmers markets, which there are several of in the area.
And give us the details now. Exactly where is it located, and what are the times?
It's in the Town Center Mall parking lot. It's off of Main Street. It's between Macy's, Sears, and the parking garage, and that's the north side of the Town Center Mall.
So it's
outdoors.
It's not underneath. It's not in the parking garage, but it's outside.
No, it's not. However, when the weather starts to get cold and rainy in the wintertime, we can move right under the parking deck and still have our market every Saturday, so we'll have no interruption.
And the times?
9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m.
Oh, good. That's a good length of time. That'll be terrific.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's every Saturday. And one more thing, we are encouraging nonprofit organizations to apply for space at the market on a rotating basis. On the 17th, United Blood Services will be out with their big blood mobile. They'll be doing blood donations on August 3rd, the North Santa Barbara County Animal Shelter will be there with adoptable pets, and we're still looking for nonprofits from the community to contact us and come out and set up a booth.
And how can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can call myself at 805-458-1907, or they can call the Town Center Mall here at 922-7931.
Okay, terrific. Well, Christy, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and we wish you the best of luck and clear sailing.
Thank you so much for having us, for allowing us to promote our market on your show.
Anytime we can promote a farmer's market, we will. They're a personal favorite of mine.
That's great. Well, perhaps you can come and visit ours.
We very well may do that. Christy Lashever of the Town Center Farmer's Market in Santa Maria, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Larry.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas, heard every Wednesday at this time from 1 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This is Larry Rutter.